Court is ready to hear oral arguments from petitioners in the consolidated cases.
May I please report, Mr. J.W. Dyer, who is an argument for petitioners.
May it please the Court, I represent the Water Supply Corporation who has sought an exemption under the Tax Code Section 1118. These water supply corporations serve the colonias and rural areas in Hidalgo County and Willacy County. And I refer to them collectively as the corporations.
Counsel, can I ask you a question to get to the heart of this that's bothering
yes.
me? Let's assume for purposes that you did properly pledge your assets. I want to go directly to the constitutional questions involved. My first question is, do you know of any case where an organization which provided goods or services was granted a tax exemption status and that organization did not have a policy of rendering its services without regard to the recipient's ability to pay?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which one?
In the San Antonio Conservation Society case versus the City of San Antonio, also in the Dallas Symphony case. Now, both of those cases are what I term as non-almsgiving type cases. The Constitution requires that there only be exemptions granted in certain instances. And those instances are, one of those instances is in institutions of purely public charity.
Counsel, the Constitution says under Article 8, Section 2 that all laws exempting property from taxation other than property mentioned in this section shall be null and void. Then one of the areas where it does refer to an exemption is institutions of purely public charity. Now, are you familiar with the Scottish Rite case?
Yes, sir, I am.
Now, it set up a three-pronged test. Does the water district meet the third prong of that test in that it benefits persons indefinite in number and personalities by preventing them all through absolute gratuity from becoming burdens to society and the state? In other words, does the water district provide any free water for anyone?
The water district, to begin with, the water district does not provide any free water to anyone. However, the Scottish Rite test, the three-pronged test spoken there, is for almsgiving situations. If you will look at the test that's provided for non-almsgiving, that's recited in the San Antonio case and in the McAllen versus the Good Samaritan case, as well as the River Oaks cases, they're talking about a test that is for non-almsgiving situation, in which case the third prong of the Scottish Rite test is changed because they're recognizing that these organizations are not the classical charitable organization in terms of taking care of the poor, taking care of the sick, anything of that nature. But these organizations are providing the service that normally would be a governmental duty or obligation, might be a governmental duty and obligation. And the test...
Didn't they deny it, though, in River Oaks?
In River Oaks, they denied the exemption based on the fact that it didn't provide for a service that would or might be a governmental duty. Educating people about how to grow flowers, they didn't find that to be something that might become a governmental duty. In this case, though, we have a situation where the service provided is providing water service, and clearly under the Constitution and under the Water Code, that's a duty of the government.
Is the Leander Independent School District case the only water district case that you know of?
Well, in addition to the Leander Water District case, there's the Military Water Supply Corporation case, the original North Alamo case, and then, of course, the North Alamo case that's on appeal here and the Sherrilland case. Those are the only water district cases, rural water supply corporation cases that I'm aware of. I don't want to get water district too much mixed up with your statutory water districts and the Water Code.
Okay. Now, the Leander case was a 1972 Supreme Court case dealing with the exemption of a water supply corporation. In that case, they held that you could not. I'm really concerned with the constitutional question that's here.
Yes, Your Honor. Remember, though, that in the Leander case, the only arguments presented to the court that I'm aware of and that are in that show up in the reported cases is they were looking to see if it was exempt as public property used for public purposes. And the question of whether it was an institution of purely public charity was never addressed. And so that question remains unanswered. And I mean, to some extent, if in fact those errors have been properly preserved, which we've indicated they're not, and are before the court, then if you're addressing the constitutionality, I think that you have to look at the argument of do they meet the requirements of an institution of purely public charity, which the Leander case didn't address.
Can you tell the court how a water district is an institution of purely public charity?
Yes, Your Honor. In addition to the first two prongs set out in the Scottish Rite test, then they meet the third prong in that they provide a service that might otherwise be a governmental duty or burden to the government. Under the Constitution, we're to conserve, the state has a policy and a duty to conserve its water resources. That's exactly what these water supply corporations do, is by providing a clean, potable water service, they conserve the water and they, in terms of the use, and by doing so, they benefit the community at large because water is not wasted, and the general community is benefited by general health conditions that are improved. Additionally, if 51% of the people of a given area voted to establish a governmental body under the Water Code, they could establish a governmental body to provide the services provided by Sherryland, by the corporation. In either case here, the corporations, if a governmental body was set up by 51%, then 49% of the people would bear a tax burden, though they wouldn't have any benefit. By setting up a governmental corporation, a supply corporation like this, the only people that are burdened with the cost of that are the 51% that make the use. The other 49% don't bear a tax burden. That is a benefit to the public as general. And that fulfills the requirement, as stated in the Good Samaritan case and in the San Antonio Conservation case, that says that the corporation must assume to a material extent that which might become the obligation or duty of the community or state. Specifically, the City of McAllen versus the Good Samaritan Society, they went into that in a little more detail, and they said that the ultimate consideration should then be based on the evaluation of the total operation of the institution engaged in humanitarian activities. And if that institution assumes to a material extent that which might otherwise become the obligation or duty of the community of the state, then it's fulfilled that requirement. That third prong is slightly different when you're talking about a non-almsgiving type situation. For example, an institution that preserves a historical monument, that provides a symphony, or something of this nature.
With reference to that prong, then, how did your client think it would be any utility?
First of all, when you say any utility, I guess you're talking about, say, electrical utility. In that case, There's no state duty to provide electricity. There is a state duty. There is a governmental duty to provide water, or there might be a duty under certain fact situations. And so there's one difference, and I think a primary difference is you look to see, is the burden that's being relieved of the state one that the state might have to bring upon itself? And if that is true, as in this case, in that the state has to provide water, if that's the factor correctly, then it fulfills the requirement. If you're talking about an electrical utility or some other type of utility, a cable TV utility, those clearly are not provided for in any, particularly not on any constitutional level and not on any statutory level that I'm aware of.
Are you familiar with Hilltop Village versus Kerrville Independent School District?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
Well, you know, the state has recognized its duty to help and take care of the elderly. But yet, in that particular situation, the nursing home was denied a tax exemption because it would not let people in who could not afford to pay.
Your Honor, that is an almsgiving case. And under the almsgiving situation, you have to have a provision that allows for services without regard to payment. And Hilltops did not have that provision. And even after they provided the provision and it went back down, and after they had amended their articles of incorporation, the court further said, well, not only do you have to have the provision, but you have to engage in it actively. And of course, in this case, both the corporations have been stipulated to engage actively in providing water. That's all they do.
What is the water district doing to provide or help those who cannot afford to pay for water?
There's no requirements that they provide that. They are providing a government service that benefits the public as a whole. It does not necessarily benefit, the immediate beneficiary is not the public, the whole public, and that's not a requirement either.
Does a private school fit within your parameters?
Well, private schools, of course, Your Honor, are covered by a separate clause within Section 8, Article 8, Section 2 of the Constitution, and so, yes, but I mean, it really does become the barrier.
I'm just trying to think of some area with an analogy.
Is there an area
now? I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Utility is trying to make a profit, so that's not really an analogy. I take it you do not make a profit.
That's correct. These are non-profit corporations.
They don't make distributions to their shareholders.
Absolutely not. Both the articles of incorporation and the bylaws provide that.
Does anything come to mind to you of a similar type of operation in the state that would not be covered by another area of constitutional protection?
I'm sorry,
anything like a water company besides water company?
That would be covered here?
Yes.
Well, I mean, you've got several non-almsgiving type situations listed in Section 1118. In fact, Section 1118 in 1985 had 13 specified functions. Of those 13, only four of them required almsgiving. The other nine were non-almsgiving situations. They provided for historical monument care. They provided for museums. They provided for symphonies and this type of thing. Those are not. There's no requirement in each of those that it be given without regard to payment. Currently, under the current status of Section 1118, we have 16 specified activities. Still, only four of which are almsgiving type, and the remaining 12 are non-almsgiving. And so, yes.
But you admit that some of those don't fall within the constitutional requirement.
No, sir, I don't.
Oh,
no, sir, I don't admit that.
I thought you said that the certain items like symphony or museum or historical preservation were not carrying out duties which the state necessarily would have a duty to do.
I am not aware.
It didn't come within the constitutional parameters.
No, I'm not aware of any of those that don't come within some type of recognized governmental duty. Now, clearly, several of them don't have constitutional mandates like this one does. This one has a water conservation constitutional mandate. I know that, for example, in the San Antonio Conservation Society, they talk about the benefits of preserving a historical building like the Jose Navarro House. And there they talk about the Antiquities Code, but they don't talk about a constitutional mandate. They provide their statutory authority providing for a duty. There's no constitutional. And I haven't tried to address each of the other 9 or 12 categories to see if each of them, what authority they have for being there. I do know that in this specific instance, with respect to furnishing water, that is not only a statutorily mandated duty in the Water Code, but is a constitutional mandated duty in Article 16, Section 59 of the Constitution. A minute ago, a question was raised with respect to the public issue as to whether the segment of society that's being served by these corporations is a broad enough segment to qualify as being public. First of all, there's no restriction on who drinks this water. Yes, it's only provided to members who come in and make an application, and membership is kind of a bad word, because if you come into if you're a citizen in the city and you come in and apply for water, it's the same type membership. You're basically making an application, you're a user. But there's no restriction on who can come in and use that water, and so it benefits the public in that manner. In addition,
is there evidence of who the members are of either water company?
Your Honor, it was stipulated that the membership is the rural community in the Sherland case. And of course, the articles of incorporation in the North Alamo case show what the purpose of. I'm not sure. I'm sure there was evidence that was presented as to who they served, but that doesn't. I can't cite it to you directly.
Do they have defined geographic areas?
Yes, Your Honor. These organizations are regulated by the Water Commission. They have certificates of convenience and necessity. These certificates of convenience and necessity designate the area that they are. That they have a right to provide service in, and it also requires that they provide service to anyone in that service area that requests it. Now, it doesn't require that they do it without payment, but if you come in and you're ready to pay your hookup fee, just like in any city, then you're entitled. Then you have to be served. They cannot refuse service.
Do you pay a membership or hookup fee? Do they give you an ownership interest?
it doesn't give you an ownership interest because it's a nonprofit corporation. There's no equity in it. It gives you a membership. They use the word membership, but it's more you're a user. You have applied.
Sell it. Do you sell it for exactly what you paid for it, or maybe you sell it for a greater price? Assume the value of the homes has gone up. Maybe you sell your membership in the water district for a higher price.
You cannot sell your membership. That was a problem in the original North Alamo case, and now through both bylaws within the corporation and by law now, you are not allowed to sell your membership. You can transfer your membership under certain circumstances. You can transfer it with your property. You can transfer it to certain relatives within a certain degree of consanguinity. And I believe you can transfer it. I believe that's about the only way you can transfer it. So no, there's not, you can't go out and sell it. There's no private gain that's provided there. You can transfer it when you sell your house and move away. You can transfer the right to receive the water, the membership to receive the water, but it's not a property right that is independent. It's basically, it's like at the city. If it's already hooked up, you can transfer the account. And
your
that's
right
basically what it means.
On your ownership of the land, so within the district. The right would depend on the title of the land within the district.
In the Sherryland case, membership is restricted to landowners. But in the North Alamo case, that's not necessarily true. You can be a tenant. You can be but it
goes with the land, whatever your right or title to the land is.
It can go with the land. It's not needed. I mean, you can forfeit it and walk away and then not have the service.
But you can't have an interest without having some interest in land.
Without having some interest in land, yes, sir, I believe that would be correct. You could be a renter or a tenant. An apartment renter and be able to have a hookup, but of course it wouldn't do you any good. It's not something you can speculate in and have a bunch of them over here that you're going to sell.
You can live over the next county and say I'm going to buy up so many shares of that corporation over there.
No, Your Honor, you have to have a land interest in the that can be served, because the meter is to serve some particular land within the service area. It's a nonprofit corporation. There's no equities involved. You can't buy stock. You have members and that's about the extent of it.
In the Dallas Symphony case, if I remember correctly, the court pointed out that it was funded largely by private contributions, and yet it was open to everyone.
Well, I believe that they made note that there were private contributions. I don't know of any requirement that be true. I think it was noted that was true. They didn't specify as to whether the people that came to the symphonies had to pay any fee. Just like in the conservation, the San Antonio Conservation Society case. I don't know, and it never was addressed, or at least it's not written in the opinion, as to whether the people that go to Jose Navarro House have to pay an entrance fee, and if that fee is waived. It's a non-issue in these circumstances, in the non-almsgiving circumstances, it's a non-issue because they are fulfilling a governmental duty. And so there's no requirement that it be given away or that there be a provision to give it away. That's the difference between the non-almsgiving and the almsgiving situations. Now, you can't have a non-almsgiving organization that, and I think that's the test that was set out in the Good Samaritan case. You can't have a non-almsgiving organization that does a humanitarian activity, but that activity is not a governmental, would not or might not be a governmental duty. It has to fit into both categories. That was the problem in River Oaks. I don't think the court had a problem with saying that it might be humanitarian to teach people how to grow gardens and grow flowers. They just simply said that would not be a burden that might fall to the government if they weren't doing it.
But on the nursing home case, you know, they are in a particular area, but they only service those who can pay, just as you do.
You're talking about in the Hilltop case.
Right.
But again, in the Hilltop, you're not talking about a governmental duty. You're talking about a charitable organization that is a almsgiving type organization. Now, I guess an argument could be made that, well, wait a minute, if these elderly weren't taken care of, that it might become a duty of the government. The way that the Section 1118 is set up, though, there's a specific provision that if you're going to provide care to the elderly like this, that you do it without regard to payment. And it's not set up as a non-almsgiving type situation. I'm not sure that there is a governmental duty. One might be recognized, and maybe it could have been framed differently, but the legislature was given the authority to exempt institutions of purely public charity. They don't have to exempt all of them in every case. They can carve out the ones that they feel are fit, and in this case, the way they've carved it out is they've carved it out as an almsgiving type charity.
Now, this battle has been going on since 1887. Am I correct? That's the first case?
The first case that I'm aware of is the Morris case. I'm afraid I don't remember the date on it. And then after that came the Scottish Rite case, which is a 1921 case.
Yeah.
But in those cases, the early statutes were all almsgiving type statutes, and the language involved, which makes it very difficult when you look at those cases, is the language in the Constitution and the language in the statute were the same. They referred to institutions of purely public charity. And it wasn't until later on that the legislature began to develop these non-almsgiving type charities and provide for their exemption. And that began in Article 7150.
I agree with you that the legislature has provided those non-almsgiving, but that doesn't change the fact that the Constitution of the State of Texas has specific terminology.
Yes, Your Honor,
that's where I'm having my problem.
The scope of what is allowed as an institution of purely public charity under the Constitution is not necessarily filled. In fact, the court has said it was not filled by the definitions given for almsgiving type organizations. If in fact only almsgiving type organizations could be institutions of purely public charity, then this court in the San Antonio case and this court in the Dallas Symphony case would not have been able to find that exemption was allowed in those situations, because those are not almsgiving situations. Those are non-almsgiving. There's no requirement that the service be provided without regard to payment. There's no requirement spoken about in the court. And there's no requirement in Section 1118 under the specific functions that are provided there.
You do agree that Section 1118 is subject to the Constitution?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that Section 1118 is an attempt by the legislature to use the authority that's given to them by the Constitution to exempt certain types of institutions of purely public charity. And it's an attempt to define which institutions of purely public charity they're going to exempt. I don't think that Section 1118 is by any means fills the total scope of what might be allowed under institutions of purely public charity. It's just the ones that the legislature has defined up until now.
So you see that as the legislature's attempt to read the Constitution?
Yes, Your Honor. The Constitution
it may be neither exclusive nor inclusive. I mean, we may decide their list is over-inclusive or under-inclusive.
Well, of course, you may decide that it's over-inclusive. My position is that I don't know whether it fills the total scope of what's allowed as an institution of purely public charity or not. I think that everything that has been listed in there thus far, at least to the point that I've studied, is qualified in being there. There may be some individual listed activities that might exceed the scope. I haven't tried to address each of them, but I do know that this one does not exceed the scope. Because
is there legislative history that shows clearly that the legislature was attempting to enact Section 1118 with due regard for the Constitution, and therefore we should give
I believe there is
to that interpretation?
I believe there is. And Mr. Glenn Jarvis, who will provide rebuttal, has done an extensive outline of that, and I think he can address it more clearly than I can. Finally, I would like to touch on the argument that the district is not properly organized, and I've already talked about the fact that it does provide a public service. The organization argument that's been raised by the appraisal districts is one that they haven't organized properly because they don't provide services without regard to ability to pay. I mean, they're trying to contort the statute to bring in the requirements of Scottish Rite. And I think that that's been addressed adequately in the Dallas Symphony case, in the River Oaks case, in the San Antonio Conservation Society case. Those cases says that the court must only look at the purposes clause of the Articles of Incorporation to determine if it's properly organized. If the clause provides for a specific purpose to carry out a specific function found in Section 1118C1, then it's properly organized. Section 1118C1G says that the corporations are to acquire, to be acquiring, storing, transporting, selling, distributing water. There's no requirement in there that it be done without regard to ability to pay, and therefore one doesn't need to be read in, and they are properly organized. We did skip over, kind of, to get onto the constitutional issue, we skipped over the problem that the Court of Appeals had, and that was, have the assets been properly pledged? The only thing that is in the Purposes Clause of the Articles of Incorporation is that these corporations are going to provide water. They're going to furnish water. That's the only thing that's provided in there. The courts have consistently said that if you state something in your Purposes Clause, then your assets can only be used for that purpose. That's a dedication. That's a pledge of assets, and the statute doesn't require an express pledge, and the fact that the corporations have provided the purpose that they have effectively pledges their assets. You want to look at the history behind that. Really, dedication and pledge were tied together before. The court has said that the corporation had to be dedicated to a certain purpose, to a charitable purpose, and that it had to pledge its assets upon dissolution to another organization that was properly qualified. That's where those words really come in. And both of these corporations have done that. They've provided that they're nonprofit corporations. They've provided that their sole purpose is to furnish water. They're actively engaged in that, and that's all. They've provided that on dissolution that it goes to a qualified organization, and there's no contention as to whether that is effective. So I don't believe that under the current case law, with the exception of the two cases that are on appeal here, that there's anything to support the fact that they haven't properly pledged their assets. They have. The only thing they could do more is to put in a provision in their bylaws that says, we pledge our assets. They've done that through putting in the proper purposes clause. That's what you held in the Dallas County Appraisal District versus Lee's case, and then, all right, at least the application for writ of error in that case was denied, and that's what the case stated. So, Section 1118 is constitutional. It's not null and void. It provides, it meets the test of the Constitution with respect to institutions of purely public charity, and it meets it two ways. It meets it for an almsgiving group, and it meets it for the non-almsgiving group, with two different tests that have been upheld by this court. These corporations have met every requirement in the statute, and there's no real contention that they haven't. The only contentions that they haven't are the attempts by the appraisal districts to contort the language to bring in the requirements of Scottish Rite, and that's just not a proper way to address it. So both of these corporations are entitled to exemptions as a matter of law.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please report, Mr. Russell Graham will present argument from respondents.
May it please the court, I'm going to start by defining what respondents see as several basic tenets of law that we feel are applicable to this case. These tenets have been set forth by this court over the years, and they are as follows. First, the burden to establish qualification for exemption is always on the institution claiming. Second, statutes providing exemptions are always to be viewed strictly and narrowly. Third is really the reason for the first two, and y'all set this forth in Bullock versus National Bank shares, and that is that exemptions are the antithesis of equal and uniform taxation, which is the standard established by Article 8, Section 1 of the Constitution. Fourth rule, in determining whether an organization is charitable in nature, you've got to look beyond the written documents outlining their purposes to its actual method of operation. You can't just see what they say on paper. You've got to look at what they do in reality. Fifth, and I think this has already been mentioned, all laws exempting property from taxation other than those enumerated in Article 8, Section 2 are null and void by the wording of Section 2. Sixth, Texas Constitution must be read in light of what the framers meant when they wrote it. And I think that's one of the keys to this case, because as I continue on, I'm going to try and give you our understanding of what this court has said since 1976 when this Constitution was adopted. And sixth, all statutes must be read in conjunction with and in light of the relevant provisions of the Constitution which they seek to implement. Justice Cook asked a question just a while ago of counsel for petitioners as whether or not they agreed that Section 1118 had to be read in conjunction with the constitutional restrictions. He said yes, but that's not what their briefs say. That's a position they are taking here basically for the first time. They've been saying just the opposite, that the legislature has the authority to decide what is a purely public charity and that you don't have to go further than 1118. Since the earliest cases, this court has tried to determine what the framers of the Constitution meant when they included the phrase institutions of purely public charity. And Justice Cook is correct. The first case was 1987, Morris v. Royal Arch Masons. In that case, the court addressed the meaning of the word institutions and basically decided that what that meant was you have to look both at the organization and its purposes and the actual use of the property for which they are seeking an exemption. It's not sufficient that a charitable organization own the building. The building itself has to be used for the charitable purposes of that organization. It wasn't until 1921 that this court got to the remainder of that phrase in the City of Houston versus Scottish Rite Benevolent Association. In that case, the court was responding to certified questions from the First Supreme Judicial District Court of Appeals in Houston. And one of those questions is I think, the key to this whole case before you today. That question read as follows. If we assume that the property of the association was exempt under the statute, the question remains, was it exempt under the Constitution? That's the key to this case, and that's the position that respondents have taken throughout this trial. 1118 is significant.
You're saying in your reply brief that the crux of the case at bar is there's a nonprofit water supply corporation which meets all the statutory requirements of 1118. Need also provided services without regard to the recipient's ability to pay in order to be entitled to an exemption from taxation. The implicit in that is that if the water companies in this case did provide some services without regard to the ability to pay, they would be exempt from taxation. Is that your position?
I think if they did, in fact, have a policy available where they could provide these services to people who did not have the resources to pay the normal customary charges, that yes, they might very well qualify under both the statute and the Constitution.
Why haven't we decided that providing services without ability to pay is not a prerequisite to constitutional exception?
I'm sorry.
Why haven't we already crossed that bridge and said that that's not an absolute requirement of a purely public charity?
I think that you have to go back to the way the court defined the meaning of that phrase in the Scottish Rite case. Because I think what petitioners have done here is try and create a distinction without a difference. They have talked about almsgiving and non-almsgiving. It talks in terms of the wording used in the Constitution. In further defining that test, the court went on and said, charity need not be universal to be public. It is public when it affects all the people of the community or state by assuming to a material extent that which otherwise might become the obligation or duty of the community. And petitioners would have you believe that they stopped in their definition of the word public at that point. But that's not what happened. There's the next sentence there in that same definition of public that says, the care of those unable to provide for themselves certainly may devolve on those of the same community or state. Now, as I go on, I'm going to try and point out that the San Antonio Conservation case, the Dallas Symphony case, are not different kinds of exemptions.
So you're content with the rules expressed in those cases?
Certainly.
And do you agree that you can be a purely public charity without providing services without pay?
I think that if you look at the third clause in the Scottish Rite definition, which says prevent persons indefinite in personalities and numbers through absolute gratuity from becoming burdens on society or the state. If that's the key, there has to be an absolute gratuity, whether that is provided to a specific individual or a very narrow class of individuals, or whether that gratuity is offered to the public as a whole, I think is the key, not whether some organization is handing out specific dollars to a specific recipient.
So to summarize it, there doesn't have to be any specific gratuity, but there does have to be some gratuitous purpose involved.
Exactly. I think if you look at how the court defined that phrase, purely public charity, they in essence defined the word public to mean it's public if it provides for those who cannot provide for themselves in lieu of the community or state doing so.
So you make no distinction between almsgiving and non-almsgiving corporations?
I think the distinction that this court said in Scottish Rite is that both of those have to be supported by absolute gratuity from the organization in the services it provides.
What does absolute gratuity mean? Can that mean a discount?
Well, isn't that also alms a synonym for gratuity?
Certainly. Certainly.
So you're really not making any distinction then if you say that they all have to be alike.
Well,
you're not making a distinction for the almsgiving as against the other.
Okay, let's go, for example, to the San Antonio Conservation case, which petitioners would have you believe is a second kind of public, purely public charity. The question there never came up about gratuity. That was basically conceded before it got to the appellate level. But the record does reflect that the San Antonio Conservation Society did in fact donate $91,000 of its assets to purchase the Navarro House and to rebuild it, and it was stipulated that that served to the benefit of the whole public. So the issue really never was addressed in that case. The only real issue in that case, and the same is true of Dallas Symphony, was whether the service being provided was in fact one which otherwise might be an obligation of the state. In other words, in fact, the record there shows, and it's not just the state, it's the community or the state, and it was uncontradicted. The praise literature in that case did not contradict evidence brought forth in the summary judgment affidavits by the Symphony, citing, for example, or the testimony of a member of the city staff saying that if the Symphony didn't provide this service, the city would have to do so. And if the private contributors did not contribute monies to the Symphony, then the city would have to do so. That, in fact, the evidence shows in that case that the city and its whole public received substantial benefits that if the Symphony was not providing, somebody else, probably the city, would have to provide. So yes, there is, in that case, evidence that this is a function that other forms of government would have picked up if the Symphony had not done so.
Well, I've been to the Symphony a number of times, but they never let me in for free.
That's quite correct. That's quite correct. I'm on the ballet board here in Austin. And we still charge for tickets. But we have to look at where does the gratuity come from. No organization is spontaneously generated with assets necessary to extend gratuities to the public. The gratuities have to come from the members themselves, the parent organizations, and other supporters. They give a gift to the organization. That organization then has the asset to extend that gift onto the public. That's the basis of gratuity in the Dallas Symphony case. It was undisputed that it was supported largely by public grants and private donations. That gratuity extended by those supporters then was made available to the public, and the record's not real clear on this. But certainly the services of the Symphony were made available to the public at a much lower cost than if the ticket had to cover the full price of producing their productions.
So it has to be a charity in its origin. There has to have been a charitable gift to create the corporation before it can qualify?
I don't say that, no, but I think just as a practical matter, how does an organization have an asset which it can donate to a person in need unless the organization itself has acquired that asset from some other donor? The point being, in this case, there is no pool with which this organization can make a gift to those in need. They charge for the water they deliver, they charge exactly what it costs to deliver, and nobody can get it anything less than that cost.
If Shareland Water Supply Corporation gave $1,000 every year to the United Fund, would that change it?
Not at all. Not at all. That would be, to me, incidental to their operation. It'd be like saying my law firm becomes a charity because we donate to the United Fund. Our business is not donating to the United Fund. Our business is practicing law. Their business is selling water.
But selling water is a governmental. The need for water is one that's universal in society, and it's a governmental function to provide it.
I agree with that. And in fact, we stipulated that their service, in fact, was a service that government might otherwise provide. But the key is, who are they providing it to? They're providing it to the people who can pay for it. They're assuming no burden. What they are doing is leaving the burden. They mentioned at the outset that their lines go into the colonies. Well, their lines go into the colonies, but only the people in the colonies who can afford to pay the $100 membership fee, the full hookup price, and 100% of the monthly bill can get water from this organization. That's why there's a water shortage and a water problem in the colonies. There may be water lines in there, but the only people who can tap into them are the people who can afford to pay for it. Testimony at trial was the only way you can get water from these people at less than cost is to steal it.
But isn't that true of a city water supply department?
If
you're going to get it in Austin, you got to pay for it.
That's true.
Steal it.
That's true. But if you look at the Houston Light and Power case, which we've cited to you, it makes a distinction between publicly provided utilities and those provided by private entities.
But isn't the argument here, though, that this water supply corporation is standing in the place of where a public function could very well exist?
That's true, but the city also has other programs available, which are supported by their tax dollars, which make
supply water
to these customers.
You mean they have other programs to supply water?
They have other programs to provide relief to the people who cannot afford water. And
do they give me money to go buy Ozarka water?
Not Ozarka, but city. I mean, this is all kind of outside the record, but I think the answer to your question is described pretty fully in the Houston Light and Power case, the distinction between public utilities, where all revenue goes into the public purse, purely for public purposes, and to benefit the entire public, as opposed to the money going into the coffers that belong to the members of this organization and not the whole public.
But the point is, though, even the city doesn't give away water.
Not if it can afford, or if it can prevent it. That's right.
It just doesn't do it. It comes out and shuts you off.
That's right. But the city and other forms of government do provide relief from other sources to people so that they can provide pay for that water. I mean, you can't look at the city water department as one isolated piece of government. You've got to look at the entire operation of government and recognize that there are other activities going on in this city that benefit that person and allow them the resources to tap into this water.
Aren't these charitable resources, though, that the city provides, aren't similar resources available to the people in the colonias that perhaps are served by these water supply corporations?
They may be, but they're not available from these people. They're available from the other taxpayers. These people don't provide the resources to do that, like is the case when the city does it. It's the other taxpayers doing that. These people want to avoid taxes. They want us to pay taxes so that the jurisdictions can have resources to allow people to hook up to their system. I mean, that's what this case really boils down to.
One more question at that point. Now, is there a competing water supply corporation here? Is there any other entity that furnishes water to these people?
Justice Hightower, I'm not sure. That's not in the record. I know there are other ways to create water supply, such as the creation of water districts. And that's commonly done in lieu of setting up these private corporations. Those districts have the power to tax. And there are plenty of statutory procedures available for the creation of those districts. But whether or not there's actually some competition with this organization, I don't know.
The summary brief, or supplemental brief, refers to these water supply companies as, quote, water country clubs, end quote, quote, excluding the distressed and needy, end quote. What evidence of that is there in record?
Well, the record says, in both cases, that an absolute prerequisite to getting water is you pay the membership fee, which in both cases is $100. The second absolute prerequisite is you pay the full cost of them extending the line and installing the meter at your location, whatever that cost may be. And the third absolute prerequisite is you pay your bill. You pay in full for the water you receive.
Does a water district with taxing authority operate any different? I mean, are there any rules?
Chief Justice Phillips, I'm not sure. I would think, though, that the installation of the lines, and perhaps right up to the house, is part of the capital structure of a water district that's paid for by bond issues. I'm assuming you would have to pay the cost of water, yes. But there is no membership fee to participate in a water district.
But there's a hookup fee a lot of times.
There may be. I don't know.
I mean, in some utilities, I don't know about water either. I mean, you probably are outside the record. But
the key to that is that the voters have to approve the creation of that district. And whatever it does, it had to be approved by the people who let it be created in the first place. That's not the case here. In Scottish Rite, I've described to you what the court said public meant. It means the organization provides for those who cannot provide for themselves in lieu of the community or the state doing so. That court also defined what purely meant. And it quoted with approval a decision from the Kentucky Court of Appeals saying it was meant to describe the quality of the charity rather than the means by which it was administered, and that it should be wholly altruistic in the ends to be attained, and that no private interest should be fostered under the guise of charity. Can petitioners meet that test? I don't think so. If you look at the definition of altruistic, Webster's at least says it's devotion to and regard for others. What others? The stockholders of this corporation are the people who can pay in full for their membership, hookup, and service. What others do they express a regard and devotion to? One of the interesting things about this court's decision in Scottish Rite is it never defined the word charity. The court did define the entire phrase, purely public charity, and it went further to define the word public and the word purely, but it never defined what it meant by charity. But if you look at the three-part test and you take out the parts that relate to the definitions of purely public, what you end up with is the only thing that's not covered by purely in public is the phrase true absolute gratuity. As I read Scottish Rite, the court didn't define charity because charity is so elemental, it didn't need to be defined. But it was built into the overall three-part test when the court said true absolute gratuity. This court has further defined the phrase absolute gratuity in the McCallum case. You've defined it to be an unconditional gratuity, one that is extended unconditionally. And there was discussion by petitioner's counsel that the McCallum case is one where gratuities weren't offered. Well, that's wrong. What the court did in that case was describe in great detail the fact that the Evangelical Society offered its services without regard to the beneficiary's ability to pay. It extended gratuity. It did try to recoup what it spent. And there was discussion about whether an organization that had a lot of people who paid for services could still be a charity. And the court's conclusion was yes, as long as the benefits were extended unconditionally, the gratuities were offered. And that's what the city of McAllen was about. The cases that I think petitioners have relied most heavily on are the San Antonio Conservation and the Dallas Symphony. And as I said, in both of those cases, there was no contest at the appellate level as to whether or not a gratuity had been extended. That really wasn't an issue. But in both records cited by the appellate courts, there was evidence of the gratuity, even though it was not in contest. The cases, in both of those cases, revolved around defining whether the service provided was one that government might have to provide in the lieu of these organizations. Didn't have anything to do with gratuities. What we have in front of us in this case, in these two cases, is petitioners arguing two basic propositions. First, they are saying that you need not look to the Constitution, that the legislature has the power to pass a statute, and that no one has the power to challenge whether they have properly interpreted the Constitution. As I say, today, their admission that 1118 has to be read in light of the Constitution doesn't mesh with what they've written in their brief and with what the amicus brief that we got Monday says about this. Both of those documents say 1118 stands by itself. 1118 is sufficient. Their second proposition is that somehow the test set forth in Scottish Rite has become archaic because of new conditions, because of new factors. We can't apply Scottish Rite to all people claiming to be purely public charity. Well, that's just plain wrong. The test is applicable. It has worked in every single case that's come up in the last 100 years. That precedent has stood for 70 years. Before that, there's not a single case that would be contrary to it. It is good law today, just like it was 70 years ago. The amicus brief that I mentioned, I think Justice Hector asked a question earlier about, are there other organizations that might fit this pattern that the water supply corporations have here? The amicus brief cites to us a case, or cites to you a case, doesn't really involve an exemption, but the facts cited in that case really show us where petitioner's legal theory could lead. That's the Tarrant County Appraisal District versus Colonial Country Club. I say it told us where it would lead because there are ominous similarities between the country club in that case and petitioners in this case. The Fort Worth Court of Appeals pointed out that the country club was a nonprofit corporation. The Court of Appeals pointed out that the way it operated did not provide any form of private gain. The court pointed out that only dues-paying members were entitled to receive the benefits offered by the club. The court pointed out, or at least in the record, there is no evidence that any member of the public who was capable of paying for a membership in that club would be excluded if the membership was available. And the court went on to say that there's some kind of public benefit provided by the country club because there is a need to retain greenbelt open space areas in urban environments. But even if you didn't take that, certainly lots of cities have golf courses. The state owns golf courses. Conceivably, the next session legislature could come in here and say, nonprofit golf courses, nonprofit country clubs. There's not one thing different in that list of facts that I just cited to you from this corporation. It's owned by its members. People who can pay the memberships can get in. There's no private gain. If you take their theory of the law, what has been up to this point a faint pitter-patter of lobbyists treading lightly around Section 1118 will soon become a thundering stampede. I can see the country clubs, the electric co-ops, the telephone co-ops, all of these entities that are out there operating as nonprofit entities, adding their names to the list in 1118. It'll be a great day for lobbyists, but it won't be a great day for the tax bases of the taxing units in this state. I close by saying the court, Scott's right, didn't define charity. But perhaps the best way for me to close is to read you Webster, because I think it's particularly relevant. Charity, number one, benevolent goodwill toward or love of humanity. 2A, kindly liberality and helpfulness, especially toward the needy or suffering. Also, aid given to those in need. B, an institution engaged in relief of the poor. C, a public provision for the relief of the needy. 3A, a gift for public benevolent purposes. B, an institution as a hospital founded by such a gift. And 4, lenient judgment of others. Petitioners are not here because they provide charity. Rather, they're here because they seek it. They seek your lenient judgment, and they seek the assumption of their tax burden by other taxpayers. If there are no questions, I'm finished.
Any questions? Thank you, Council.
May I please report, Mr. Glenn Jarvis will present rebuttal to the bill.
May I please the court?
Jarvis, let me start off asking you a question. Are rural electric corporations exempt under this law?
No, Your Honor.
How does the Sherryland Water and North Illinois Water Supply Corporation, how do they differ from a rural electric corporation?
Because the Water Supply Corporation has been previously mentioned. In Article 16, Section 59 of the Constitution, the people of Texas declare that water is a very important thing. It's elemental to an elemental human need, and I submit that that is in a different category than in electricity. We can get by without electricity, but we can't get by without water. And it's so fundamental that it's necessary that the state, the community, provide this service because it's so fundamental.
And that is the distinction?
In my opinion, yes, Your Honor, because the state has more of an interest in the provision of water than it does in electricity. And I think that's borne out by the facts. It's not in the record, but you find many more large private for-profit electric utility companies than you do water companies. These corporations that we have here, Your Honor, are nonprofit corporations who are serving the rural community. They're in between the gaps. You take it in an area with only 10 residents, the state and the community may not say that they need to be served. But as that population grows in this rural area, there's a state interest in those people receiving treated good water. The water supply corporations in this state are providing that service.
Are there some for-profit water supply corporations?
Yes, Your Honor, they are.
That serve defined geographic areas?
I'm sure they are. These two particular ones that are involved here are not. They're nonprofit, and all the revenues, their initial funding came from FHA because it was difficult for them to get funding. And all of those revenues are going back to pay debt service on their facilities and to go into capital improvements and maintenance of the facilities that they have. So the money circulates back into the facility itself.
Well, in that respect, though, they're like an REA.
Somewhat, yes, Your Honor.
Well, accepting your argument about the fundamental nature of water supply, how do you differ from the Colonial Country Club in Fort Worth that was referenced by counsel?
That case is really not, that case involved a country club's claim to some greenbelt evaluation. And in my opinion, that case is not appropriate here. They weren't talking about an exemption as a purely public charity. They're not talking about a corporation where all of the funds, these corporations have no shareholders. The members are only The only significance of being a member is that you're entitled to a service from the corporation, a water service. And as a matter of governance, the members are entitled to vote. They elect from their own the members of their board of directors. That case is really not appropriate here. I would say
the mention of water in the Constitution is important and indicative of a desire of people to treat it differently. Why won't they approve amendments that would specifically exempt water companies like yours from taxation?
Your Honor, you mean constitutional amendments?
Yes.
I don't believe that we need a constitutional amendment. I don't believe that when you pass the constitutional amendments that we're all familiar with and the manner in which we do that, that it can be argued that the public has expressed themselves. But when you go on the voting booth, I don't know that the public is really expressing themselves when you see a long line of very complicated propositions. I don't believe that we need a constitutional amendment. I think that this statute is constitutional. And I submit the reason we're talking about the Constitution here today and some of the other things is that finally we're getting to the root of this thing. Only in the North Alamo case was a matter of constitutionality raised in the lower court. It wasn't in the Sherland case. I would submit to you that if you step back a minute and look at what's happening, the cases that I could find that this court has considered since the amendment in the Constitution are less than a dozen. There are less than 10 that this court has considered interpreting what an institution of public charity is. Actually, there's about 10. Two of those were in the 1920s, one of which is a Scottish Rite case. Certainly, the respondents are talking about the Scottish Rite case because that was the case of the 20s. We're talking about the San Antonio Conservation case, a case by Judge Polk. It's the only unanimous decision by this court interpreting this provision of the Constitution. And as you look, you see what is happening as we all see. From the 20s and beginning in the 60s, actually there was about a 40-year gap there before this court got involved, and actually it's been 15 years since this court has involved itself in this issue. But the court and the legislature, there's many things changed since the late 20s. To what we have today. And the courts were reacting to that. So what Judge Polk said in the San Antonio Conservation case was that an institution of public charity is keyed in to whether there is a service. It's the common thread of all of this. It's a service that's open to the public, that is done, that the duty or obligation of the government. And he's done in a manner like the government does it, non-profit.
Didn't Judge Pope say in the San Antonio Conservation case that the public as a whole benefited from this particular organization and not just the people who were paid members of the society?
Well, you see, the courts have said that when you talk about public, we're talking about public in a particular community or a particular state, a particular area. And so really the community and the state is fulfilled, its interest is fulfilled in what these corporations do, even though you or I may not drink the water that they serve. It serves the state interest that they serve these people in this geographic area, which they do. All the people in their geographic certified area by the Water Commission is entitled to service.
But surely an REA serves people as well as a symphony or historical.
I don't believe that the state has come along. The state has come along that says, and if you look at 11.18 and think about it, you'll see that since the 1920s, we're beginning, the society has changed. The government is assuming different roles. The government is saying that we need museums. We need culture. And this is a government function. And
well,
these...
So what you're saying is, that REAs are not going to be taxed until the legislature puts
them in. No, I think until we see that it's in the public interest that REAs are an institution of public charity. I submit to you, Your Honor, that if you And every time I read these cases, the San Antonio Conservation case and Judge Norville's decisions are very clear that an institution of public charity is not, under law, the same thing as a traditional concept of charity. And if you read the decisions carefully, the word purely only relates to the quality of the service. Again, it's a service that's offered by the government, or should be, or might be, is what it says. Because it's the people to decide what the government ought to offer. The word public and charity actually become together in the sense that charity means what the people through the government believe that is in the interest of the public to have. And then that service should be provided to the public. And that's what an institution of public charity is under the law, I submit to you today, under the court decisions of this court. In other words, there is a distinction, and one way to understand and read the cases is the almsgiving and non-almsgiving, because an animal shelter is a non-almsgiving. A museum, a zoo. Water is the only utility, but it's the only utility, the only service is of utmost importance to the government.
I know it's not up to me, but it just looks like to me that electricity is as important as a zoo.
Well, if we all agree with you that is a service that the government should be involved in and requiring, of course the government does regulate, then it would be. But under the facts and circumstances as we know them, the situation today, it has not risen to that. Whereas it has risen that people need treated water. In this area of the valley, the people were drinking, the groundwater is no good to drink. The canal water, I grew up on the canal water, but nowadays it shouldn't be to drink. So the state says these people ought to have a water supply. And these corporations are fulfilling that need. They meet the criteria. The revenue that they receive goes back into the facility so that others can be served. The FHA, their grants, council has suggested about the city underwriting these things. Well, there are grants that underwrite the payment of the fees of the user. That's how this is done, and it's similar in the city. And I submit to you on the almsgiving thing that if you look through this and analyze it, you'll see that if the government charges when it does this service, then the charitable institution can charge. Cities charge for their water. Corporations can charge.
But the city's also,
museums.
The city's also taxed.
The city's also taxed. So I submit that is what is happening here. That the legislature and the courts, because I submit that under your prior decision since the 60s, that the courts are supporting that. These institutions of public charity, as now defined, should be on equal footing with the city. The city's property is not taxed. They should be on an equal footing, and that's what we're talking about. It's in the public interest, and it's a strong interest of the government that private enterprise perform some governmental functions. And it's a matter of public policy that is encouraged, and they should be on an equal footing as the government. The government has said, we want museums. We want zoos. Our standard of living is increasing. Now the government is saying we need these other things. In the 20s, we hadn't got to that point yet, but we are today. And these institutions that are providing services, that is an obligation or duty to government, and a manner in which the government does it, is an institution of public charity, beginning with the San Antonio Conservation case, in cases since that time that have recognized and interpreted the Constitution.
Any questions? Thank you, Counsel. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. That concludes the business of the court. for the day. The marshal will please adjourn the court.